The White House has announced that President Trump will meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in May. Sets the scene for an encounter between two nations that only recently threatened to wipe each other out. It's one of the developments this week, and it's time for a Week in Review. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Also this week, the president advanced his America First trade policy yesterday with the signing of an order to launch global tariffs on steel and aluminum. But it was not without pushback from foreign leaders, GOP congressional leaders, and closer to home, Governor Scott Walker made it the topic of his weekly radio address.
The goal of the president's administration, I believe, is to protect American workers. Unfortunately, the practical application here of the tariff on steel and aluminum would likely lead to jobs being lost in Wisconsin and moved not to other states, but to other countries.
What do you make of these tariffs? Will it cause a trade war? Join in Week in Review at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org or mention at WPR Mornings on Twitter. Now let's dive into the headlines with John Sharpless, a history professor at UW-Madison. John, welcome to the program.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
And Joe Winicky, a former state senator and former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. Joe, welcome to you.
Well, good morning.
Good morning. Well, against the objections, as we've been hearing now this week, of more than 100 GOP lawmakers, it's also spooked markets. It's ramped up this talk of a trade war. The president will push forward with tariffs, signing the order yesterday, surrounded by metal workers. John, first with you, is this a good idea, bad idea? Where do you come down on this move?
Well, as I mentioned just before the show, there's something charming about the Republican Party returning to the 19th century when they used to support high tariffs. Tariffs have been a debate in America since our founding. Hamilton wanted tariffs and Jefferson didn't. It was a source of considerable animosity between the two. So it's been a major American issue for a long, long time. I do know that there is some problem with free trade. I understand that. Some industries do suffer. But I think, this is my opinion, I have got a couple of economics degrees. I think overall America prospers in free trade. That doesn't mean we sign off on trade agreements that diminish our buying power in the world, but I think tariffs are, people have to remember, a tariff is a tax. There's no other way around it. It's a tax. And if you're in the industry that's protected by the tariffs, bless you. But if you're outside that industry, if people want to pay more for an automobile to support the steel industry, I suspect they don't.
Well, the president noted that the order could be tailored so that he could exclude countries, perhaps Canada, we're hearing this morning. Analysts are saying that they're considerably softer than what came out a week ago, giving the authority to raise or lower tariffs on this country-by-country basis. The president also weighed in on the role of NAFTA when it comes to Canada and Mexico.
We're negotiating right now NAFTA. And we're going to hold off the tariff on those two countries to see whether or not we're able to make the deal on NAFTA. National security, very important aspect of that deal. And if we're making the deal on NAFTA, this will figure into the deal and we won't have the tariffs on Canada or Mexico.
Joe Winicky, what's your take on this move by the president?
Extortion. I mean, I don't know what else you can call it. And to think that he's going to get Mexico and Canada. Oh, are we building a wall on Canada? Well, no, that was Governor Walker's idea. We're going to with Canada, the 5,000-mile wall, or is that just Mexico?
Cause yeah, those sneaky Canadians, they come down here and take our jobs.
The Canucks. Actually, short story, my relatives many, many years ago came from Ireland, and they didn't come through Ellis Island. They snuck through Canada. So yeah. I guess we better have a wall.
Well, what do you make, though, of perhaps, having this a little bit shift of balance here and going country by country on what you
tariff? That's not what he proposed. What he proposed was a blanket 25% surcharge on the cost of aluminum and steel, which in this state will destroy Harley-Davidson because a bike is basically made of steel and aluminum. And in steel, yeah, they could potentially get maybe even all their steel in the U.S. They're not going to get all their aluminum. And it's a strange thing. I agree with John. I think free trade is here, but we have, you, it isn't, free trade isn't always fair trade. So sometimes you have to create things and you have to go after the people that are cheating. Well, this 25% tariff is nothing but a tax, will hurt millions of people, including right now in Canada and Mexico and other countries in Europe. People forget about Europe, but they're one of our biggest partners with this, who are our supposed friends, because we want to get at China and a couple other bad actors. And it's just the wrong way to do it. But on the other hand, I don't think you should sit back and say all trade should be free trade. It should be free and fair. And right now, go after the fairness. And Trump never gets any of this. And then to say, oh, we'll do this if you'll, I mean, when he talks about security, he's really talking about a wall.
So Wisconsin's Republican leaders were raising their alarm bells. House Speaker Paul Ryan isn't a fan. And then Senator Ron Johnson called it self-destructive on CNN this week.
And I just view this as potentially, if it's widespread, if it's targeted toward China, depending on how it's tailored, I mean, I have a problem with it, because that is really where the root cause of the problem is, the gross oversupply within China,
right,
and their trade abuses. But a generalized tariff that would actually harm allies, harm American consumers, by the way, harm American workers that use steel in production, hurting their competitive nature in
right.
global markets as well, I'm opposed to that.
So, John, do you think the president's going to be moderating his position here? And will this get at China?
He'll moderate it. He has to. I mean, the fascinating thing about Trump generally is he's not a conservative and he's not a Republican. He's Trump. And he's going against something that the Republican Party has stood for since World War II. At the heart of the Republican Party has always been free trade, negotiated trade agreements. It's very important to Democrats as well. There are people, representatives in areas that have suffered as a result of free trade. They often speak for tariffs and restrictions. But by and large, the American people have prospered under free trade. He will change his position. If this is aimed at China, and by the way, it should be, then that should be the target, not Canada or Mexico.
Or Europe.
Let's go to Tim with reaction in Racine. Good morning, Tim. Oh, and Tim just dropped there. So sorry. I think we lost Tim there. Getting your reaction on the tariffs at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Morning. So, Joe Winnicke, what's the next step here? We're going to see the rollout of these tariffs in 15 days.
Yeah, and nobody knew it was even coming until a week ago. I mean, this is not a way to run your government. But this is a consistent opinion of Donald Trump's for 20-some years. He's always talked this way, which means he'll cave. He just wants to go to his base and get everybody's minds off strippers and everything else for a few days. And this is one way to do it. The same thing with North Korea. And, you know, from my perspective, Trump never follows through on anything he ever proposes, but he can go back to his base because this is all about his 35% of the country. And he can say, look, I'm keeping my promises. It doesn't mean he's going to actually do any of this stuff.
John Sharpless, from an economic standpoint, what will you be watching here as these tariffs roll out?
I do think there's an interesting process at work. The problem is that Trump has not been able to draw the very best people out of economics and trade policy. There is something important happening here. We have often been on the short end of the major trade agreements, and returning to those for renegotiation is a very good idea. I just wonder about the kind of expertise that's being... Remember, we're negotiating right now in the Pacific region. We're negotiating on NAFTA. We're looking again at our agreements with Europe. So there's a lot going on. And I what worries me about this administration as a whole is not so much Trump's kind of impulsive back and forth, his sending out messages that are conflicting. I worry that they don't have a cadre of good people at the level to negotiate the best contracts with other countries. That's my worry. He hasn't been able to draw expert. I would even want, It doesn't matter if they're conservative economists or liberal economists. I'd like to see some economists.
What do you make of the departure of Gary Cohn, economic advisor?
That was telling. It was telling. That's why Wall Street's, when one of their favorite people says, I'm done with this, I'm leaving the ship, that was a signal to the Wall Street community that the behavior of our president is erratic.
And what do we have left, Jared and Ivanka?
Well, let's go to Susan now in Burlington with reactions. Susan, go ahead.
Hi, I'm a farmer, and so often when something like this happens, it's the unintended consequences that we have to worry about. And agriculture prices right now are very low. Wisconsin really depends on the ability to send their products, their high-quality dairy products, out and export them, export corn, export wheat, export soybeans, export our cheese. What happens to us if people retaliate?
Susan, thank you. And Joe Winicky, you mentioned the residual effect there in other industries. Harley is one of them, agriculture another.
Well, agriculture, absolutely. I mean, one of the great winners of free trade has been the agricultural industry in Wisconsin. And because there's fewer and fewer farmers, they may be larger than they used to be. You know, if you get away from the organic farms and the more smaller craft operations, they often get ignored in this debate, but, you know, I still remember when I look at my license plate, I believe it still says America's Dairyland.
And we're going to remember it. We're going to try to get rid of that.
Oh, yeah, I suppose.
Let's go to Kirsten in Waupun. Hi, Kirsten. Are you there, Kirsten?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I was thinking that, really any idea that Trump might have is kind of in his own pocket. And what I was thinking was that, you know, this is one more step away from good American policies. It's going to ruin Harley Davidson. It's going to, you know, take away any kind of industry that we have, you know, in Wisconsin and in America. And it's going to create our allies to turn the other way. It already is starting to do that. And one more step closer to a depression. And I just want to know what's going to be done about it. You know, when things were happening in the 60s and the 70s, things were changing because the people were standing up and saying no more, no more.
John Sharpless, Kirsten is worried we're one step closer to a depression.
I don't know about that. There's always gloom and doom talk about the economy. The indicators look pretty good right now in most sectors of our economy. At least in the intermediate run, I think we're going to see an economy that grows. The problem with tariffs is more long run. It produces an artificial environment. I want to sound like a conservative economist here. It produces an artificial environment for the production of goods. And there is this naive notion that if a protected industry generates larger profits, that they're going to hand them down in the form of higher wages, and that's just naive. There's a kind of nostalgia here, smokestacks in Pittsburgh turning out steel. That hasn't been the case since the 1970s. So it's just unlikely that you're going to see a substantial boom in steel production in America. It's just simply going to mean that steel companies can now profit. I would suspect they'll figure out ways to import steel. They'll pretend it's their steel, and they'll sell it here.
Let's bring in Mike in Madison with reaction. Mike, go ahead.
I'd like to say that I would support this idea because it will reduce greenhouse gases from fossil fuel business and transportation, which will reduce the threat of runaway global warming.
So, Mike, it's a little muffled there, but I think you're saying that this will reduce the use of fossil fuels in the transportation industry. Any reaction there before we move on?
How?
I'm not sure I see the connection. I'd like to go back to Susan's remark about agriculture. China is the largest consumer of soybeans in the world. That's one of our major markets for the American soybean production. If we want to get into trade war with China, our agricultural sector will suffer horribly.
You are with us for Week in Review. John Sharpless, a history professor at UW-Madison. Joe Winicky is a former state senator and former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. Getting your insights on the week's news at 800-642-1234. What do you think of a proposal to divert water from Lake Michigan for Foxconn? Do you agree with the Justice Department's decision to sue California this week over its sanctuary policies? Call in, tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll get back to this discussion in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on Week in Review. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. At the table this week, it's Joe Winicky. He's a former state senator and former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. John Sharpless is here as well. He's a history professor at UW-Madison. You can join in the conversation. What developments caught your eye this week? 800-642-1234. President Trump has agreed to meet face-to-face with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. That's according to White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said yesterday. Meeting is between the two is expected in a couple months. We've been hearing May. First of all, Joe, what do you make of this move?
Well, I think anytime you have discussions between antagonists, it's a good thing. But I am really worried that the person who might agree to this might be the chief antagonizer, and that'd be Donald Trump. And what my fear really is, we don't have the infrastructure in place to negotiate with. We don't have an ambassador to South Korea, which is critical in this mess. Yesterday, Rex Tillerson, 20 minutes before Trump came out with this, clearly did not even know he was going to do it. He's our Secretary of State. We just lost our senior envoy in the Pacific region. Who is going to do this? Ivanka and Jared?
Well, John, with this meeting, North Korea gets its recognition. It gets a platform on the international stage. What do you make of that?
He got what he wanted. It's easy to appreciate this guy. I mean, he's a caricature of himself. He's almost a joke. But he got what he wanted. He drove forward on the atomic program to a point that it was so successful that he was threatening. And that gave him that access to that stage. It is really impressive when you think about it. These two men meeting, it's going to be either clownish and silly, and they simply poke at one another in a kind of belligerent way. Or maybe, I mean, certainly Trump has had his moments of being gracious. It might come off as a meeting of the great minds. That's the way he's going to present it to the world. He's going to present what he's going to argue is that with his aggressive policies, he has forced North Korea to come to the table, so he'll be able to pound his chest when he gets back home. I really think this could be a breakthrough, though, however. Now, Joe's quite right. One of the problems is at the next level, the hard negotiations. I'm not sure we have. One more time, the lack of expertise in this administration is showing itself. They haven't been able to recruit the kinds of people that previous administrations have consistently have. It's a vacant administration. It's simply devoid of people.
Oh, one other thing on that, which John touched on. I really think Kim Jong-un wanted to get Donald Trump to the table. So Kim Jong-un is a winner right off the bat, even if it blows up in his face later, because he gets recognition on the world stage.
So what does that mean to the balance of power in the world? You have, you know, access to this world stage, but you also have global powers and superpowers who are then wondering where they stand.
I think this is fascinating. So for a long time, the nations that had the potential for nuclear war was a very small community. Right. This may signal to countries that they can leverage themselves, no matter how small, no matter how alienated from the world they are, they can leverage that with atomic energy.
Absolutely.
That's a frightening world. Do you want every little small country to have an atomic bomb or two or three? That would be a troubling world.
It's the mouse that roared and with an atomic bomb.
Yeah.
Let's turn now to Wisconsin. The Department of Natural Resources held a public hearing this week on a proposal from Foxconn to divert millions of gallons of water from Lake Michigan every day for its planned manufacturing campus in Racine County. The governor contends Foxconn will bring jobs back without harming lake water levels, but environmentalists are concerned here that this is going to have an effect on water quality. The DNR is expected to make a decision later this spring. Joe, you first. Where do you fall on this?
Well, I'm against it. I mean, this whole Foxconn thing, it's been crazy. It's the largest state subsidy of a private sector business in American history. I think we're up to that we know of $4.3 billion, which accounts to the basically, I think we're paying for the first 5,000 employees now at Foxconn for 15 years. Really? And in this case, I'm just going to divert for a second. I'm against what they're doing there, but I'm just going to make a call to any Democratic candidate for governor. This is your issue. Every time that Scott Walker tries to make Foxconn the great thing, you remind him that that $4 billion could have gone to public schools, could have gone to highways, could have gone to take care of senior citizens with Alzheimer's disease. It could have, you name it, you've got it. Does it sound like class warfare? Maybe a little bit. But Scott Walker created it when he created one class, and it was a Taiwanese billionaire.
John, the Chicago Tribune headline this week was, Foxconn finds way to stick 7 million gallon straw into Lake Michigan. That headline stuck with me. The plant will be outside the Great Lakes Basin, but it can get its water source. What do you make of that?
I'm a bit confused on this. I thought you had to go to that commission that controls Great Lake water use, which includes Canada and all the states on the Great Lakes waterway. I thought you had to go and get permission from them. I don't think simply the DNR rubber stamping this project is the end of it. Think about it, how long it took Waukesha to fight that battle. It took almost a decade for Waukesha to fight that battle. And they finally won, mostly because, if I remember right, the governor's from Waukesha. So that might have been a privileged position. I think this thing has many more hurdles, and it may turn out to be the hurdle that sticks this project to a dead halt.
Well, another issue that's been up for consideration by the legislature and a topic this week, school safety, coming on the heels of the mass shooting at Parkland, Florida last month. The Assembly has approved grants to pay for armed guards, but that isn't a focus for the Senate. According to Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, the working proposal there would be to send an undetermined amount of general tax dollars to schools for improving building safety. And then we've had this week State Superintendent Tony Eaver saying the proposals aren't enough and asking for $50 million for mental health counselors and prevention programs. The Senate Education Committee chairman, though, Senator Luther Olson, wanted to double down on that and spend roughly doubles what Eaver's proposal is saying on school safety. So, Joe, it's a lot of ideas to wade through in an effort to increase safety there for children. What strikes you in all of this?
Nobody talked about guns. Nobody once talked about guns in everything that was just said there. They're talking about mental health and school safety. And we're running into this in Verona, which just passed the second largest school referendum in state history. I noticed on my property taxes. But they just had a big debate, and they're actually going to look at changing the design of their new high school because they figured out that the whole side of open windows would be a shooting target for somebody who wanted to just, you know, sit on a hillside and start spraying bullets. That is a good debate to have. But Luther Olson said also that this should become a categorical aid program, which I agree with. And I'm fine with that. And there's a real easy source of money to help cover this. Get rid of that ridiculous sales tax holiday that they want to have that will pit winners and losers for like one weekend in Wisconsin. I think he dumped $100 million in that. And I think there's a $100 one-time tax credit for people. That doesn't mean squat. Well, put it into something that people can benefit from.
Well, John Sharpless, on Wednesday there will be a national school walkout here in Wisconsin and across the country. Nearly 200,000 students are expected to walk out of class to draw attention to the need for stricter gun laws. What do you make of this in light of what happened this week on guns?
Well, we could be at a turning point on gun control. I suspect not. It will be in the state of Wisconsin. It'll be interesting to watch the Democrats as they position themselves on this issue. There's something there's just some numbers I have to remind you about in Wisconsin. The accuracy of polling on firearms ownership is not very accurate, but the last poll in Wisconsin said 37% of adults own at least one gun. There are 300,000 concealed carry license holders in this state. The last election, Mary Burke lost by 130,000. Do the numbers. You have to be a brave Democrat to come down hard on gun owners in this state and see if you can survive an election.
I knew there'd be, John and I always disagree on one point in this hour, and it's always guns.
Well, okay, fine.
No, but it's not that. It's the argument that every gun owner isn't for regulation of firearms, which is not fair.
Joe, if concealed, you can even have some attrition. 300,000 concealed carry. You could have a lot of stay-at-homes. You could have a number of those come down on the side of the Democratic Party for simply other reasons, you know. They're opposed to Foxconn. But that number of, clearly, if you're a concealed carry holder, you feel strongly about the Second Amendment. And if they get motivated, if they feel that their rights are at risk, remember, defenders of the Second Amendment often are single-issue people. For most people who are interested in gun control, it's one of their issues. It's simply one of the many issues, and it doesn't drive them to the polls. Let me stress, we may be at a turning point on this, but I suspect if there's not another major violent moment by fall, this will ebb as an issue.
It will ebb as an issue, but John, the one thing I think is, this is one time we're going to disagree today, as my guess.
Well, make it good.
Is that it's the assumption that all gun owners are against reasonable regulations on firearms.
We have reasonable regulations.
We do not.
We absolutely do.
We keep extending gun rights in this state over and over and over again.
We need to circle up here because we have places to go and people to see. We are going to move on to the Marquette University Law School poll. Released a new poll this week with topics on the docket ranging from background checks to those involved in the gubernatorial race. And Ray has been waiting in Milwaukee. Let's go ahead with Ray to start us off.
Yeah, good morning. I had this big debate with workers, my coworkers. What is the benefit to the public of polling when so often if your person is up in the polls, you might think, well, the person's far enough up in the polls, I don't need to vote. If your person appears to be down in the polls, you might say, well, what's the use of voting? I can't see really any public benefit from these polls and how long they've been in the last few cycles. I'm kind of sick of them. I'd like to see them go away, actually.
John Sharpless?
He might be onto something. We live and die by polling, and the last election proved that their polling is very flawed. It's extremely hard in the age of the cell phone to connect with people across all demographic groups. It used to be you could call them at home on the landline, and you knew the demography of the phone number. You knew the likelihood there was going to be an African-American or an older person. We don't know that now. So polling is terribly challenged in the modern internet world.
Well, meanwhile, we went piece by piece this week on that new Marquette University poll. The last one was released in June. The new one just came out. The poll shows that Governor Walker's job approval level is the same, holding steady from March 2014. Both then and now, 47% of registered voters gave his job performance a thumbs up, 47% disapproved, with a 6% saying they're unsure. So, Joe, the governor is heading into campaign season. Should we be watching these polls?
Well, the part that is relevant to the governor is the steady consistency of the fact that he's under 50%. And the historical number, I kind of agree with John on polling. I think it gives people who are generally apathetic and don't look for news a reason to decide who they support. And I think that's not very smart. But when it comes down to it, if I was this governor and I was sitting consistently with 47% of the people in this state saying I'm not in favor of you, I'd be very, very, very nervous about re-election.
But on the other hand, the Democratic primary remains really muddled there. According to the poll, only 33% offered an opinion about the top candidate.
Ask how many people knew who Ron Johnson was at this time in 2010. Was it 2%?
Well, John Sharpless, what do you make of that?
I don't. If the Democrats don't figure out a strategy in this thing, Walker's going to get elected again. I'm a little different than Joe on this. Remember, this is an off-year election. So if he was going into a presidential cycle with below 50%, I could see them being concerned. There has been some signals that the state might be turning against Trump, and he might get caught in the wash behind that boat. Clearly, he's distancing himself from Trump on a variety of issues already. We don't need to arm our teachers, which is a way of saying I'm different from Trump. He said we don't need to have tariffs on steel and aluminum, quietly distancing himself from Trump. So I think, Joel, since it's an off-year election, those numbers are not as difficult for him to surmount.
Well, the one place that's different, though, is there are wave elections. And in 2000, Scott Walker's been elected in 2010 and 2014, which were both Republican wave elections. 18, unless I'm missing something, is going to be a big blue wave. It's been happening all over the country. We keep winning congressional seats. We keep winning legislative seats. I mean, what have we picked up? 39 right now. It looks like we're probably going to win an election in Pennsylvania next week or the week after, where Trump won by 20 points. And if that blue wave comes, by Scott Walker.
Well, one more thing to look at in this Marquette University poll here, that on background checks, I know we just segued a little bit from the topic of guns, but 4 out of 5 Wisconsin voters favor universal backgrounds for gun purchases. 58% said they favor a ban on assault-style weapons. So the results fall in line with past trends. John, does anything there catch your attention?
Well, again, if we're talking about the election, I don't think Scott Walker has to substantially modify his views. If the Democrats want to make guns the issue of the campaign, it would be an interesting test of the people in Wisconsin. But I don't see a smart Democrat doing that. There are other issues, the environment, education, Foxconn, those would be, if I was on the stump as a Democrat, those would be the ones I would lead with. If asked, I'd have a gun control position, mm-hmm. but I'd wait for the reporter to ask me. I wouldn't lead with it.
Correct.
This is as a big gun-holding population in the state. As Joe pointed out, a lot of those people are Democrats, so they may vote a Democrat anyway. But if they feel that they're at risk in terms of their gun rights, they will show up and vote to minimize the restrictions on firearms.
Let's bring in Jeremy in Racine now. Jeremy, hi, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I voted for Walker in the general and then in the recall election. One of the disappointing things after that recall election, he had his eyes set on the presidential election, which pretty much pulled him out of the state of Wisconsin for almost a little over a year. And to me, that was incredibly disturbing, and I was a little bit irritated. He was just trying to run the sales of the recall election and see how far it would take him. But we have so much that needs to be accomplished here in Wisconsin, things need to be addressed. And I'm afraid this time around, he's really going to have to sell himself that he's going to stay in Wisconsin, govern Wisconsin, and not look towards a national stage here. We got issues that we need to take care of in the state. I don't need a governor that's just going to catapult off of Wisconsin and try and get into a presidential election or what have you. So that's my comment on that.
Jeremy, thank you so much for contributing. And before we move on, any closing thoughts there?
I think, Scott, I don't know. Excuse me. I don't know his way he conceives of his future, but I think he learned his lesson in that presidential campaign. I think he's going to stay at home. I don't think he's crafting an agenda to run against Trump one more time.
And the other small thing to think of, just to remember for listeners, every time we get to an election year, Scott Walker moves to the middle. Now, all of a sudden, he doesn't want to arm teachers. He doesn't want to do this. He doesn't want to do that. Well, come January, if he were to win again, all you got to do is ask organized labor after the last election. Because during the election, he said he would do nothing about right to work, nothing about prevailing wage. 4 months later, they were law.
It is Week in Review on the Ideas Network. John Sharpless is a history professor at UW-Madison. Joe Winicky is a former state senator and former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. Getting your thoughts on the week in the mix as well, 800-642-1234. UW-Stevens Point announced plans to cut 13 majors this week. Mark and Appleton, you hold on. And the Justice Department sued California over its sanctuary laws. Call in, email ideas@WPR.org. We'll get back with more Week in Review conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. On a Friday, you're along with us for Week in Review as we sift through the developments here in Wisconsin and across the nation, getting your reaction and what the week you served up to you. UW-Madison's history professor John Sharpless is here, as is Joe Winicky, former state senator, former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. What developments this week did you take time to absorb and reflect on? Let's talk about it at 800-642-1234. You can send an email to ideas@WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Another Wisconsin headline, sweeping cutbacks at another UW system school. The University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point proposed the elimination of 13 majors this week in order to address a $4.5 million structural deficit. Let's get Mark in Appleton to respond. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'd just like to point out that these cuts at Stevens Point, at Superior, the elimination of UW colleges, cuts coming at Oshkosh, and it's being sold. The UW system administration is kind of acting like, well, it's just demographics. And let me suggest that that's misleading, because if you look at enrollments at UW-Stevens Point in 2000 and enrollments today, they're almost the same. If you look at Oshkosh, they're actually up. UW system is up about 15,000 students or 13,000 students. So this idea that it's, well, it's just demographics is really not accurate. It's the massive cuts that the Walker administration has administered tied to a tuition freeze, which is a cut.
Mark, thank you for the call. Let's get John Sharpless here, the history professor, to weigh in.
I'm a history professor, and I'm with Mark. I'm really find this disconcerting that you're going to do away with the core set of courses that make a humanities and social science program work at a leading university. I don't know what's up here. It seems to me that if you're, and I think Mark's right, I don't know if there's been declining enrollments or they simply are leveled out. And given the cutbacks, you need to have a growing student population. But it seems to me if you reduce your offerings, you reduce people's interest in your program. So it seems to be a deadly cycle of reducing the number of applications. Why should a student apply to this university if they can't take a history course?
And wasn't the university, one of their great mottos was about sifting and winnowing? I mean... The other thing was, when I went to the university in Madison, we had breadth requirements. We had to take a broad variety of things. You know, you took that beginning level history class. You did these different things, and maybe that stoked your interest in something you didn't know you wanted.
But according to the provost here, it's you've got budget cuts, declining enrollment, you've got a six-year imposed tuition freeze. Are their hands tied?
Well, get a new legislature which stops all these tuition freezes and stops the revenue drain. Remember, it was Scott Walker who cut $250 million out of the university in his first term. And I think they've finally gotten back to that level after 8 years. They're about where they were before.
Well, let's turn to some national headlines. The Justice Department sued California this week over three state laws passed in recent months that they say make it impossible for federal officials to deport criminals born outside the country. Let's listen to Attorney General Jeff Sessions in Sacramento.
California absolutely, it appears to me, is using every power it has, powers it doesn't have, to frustrate federal law enforcement. So you can be sure I'm going to use every power I have to stop that.
So, John Sharpless, beginning with you, what do you make of this move by the Trump administration?
I get a big kick out of this. This is so funny. We talked about this a couple weeks ago. Maybe it was a month or so ago. People love federalism when they've got an issue that they want to stand on states' rights, and they hate federalism when they have when they want the federal authority to intervene in local affairs. Jerry Brown standing with George Wallace shoulder to shoulder to block federal authorities in his state is just, to me, charming.
A little opposite bull at the other end of it. One was trying to block blacks, and the other is trying to allow Hispanics
in. But it doesn't matter, Joe. It's a governor trying to stop federal authority in the state.
That part's true.
It's really charming.
Will this make it to the Supreme Court?
Look at the decisions by the Supreme Court all the way back, even before the Civil War, says you can't do this. And the Civil War settled it once and for all. It turns out the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution says the federal government is supreme. It has the power. They're going to have once they show up in court, they're going to have a really difficult time providing legal precedent for blocking federal authority. It's going to be tough.
But saying that, I think this really isn't. Once again, it's not about actually following through. It's about playing to that 30 or 35% that's left of Trump's base. This is just, I mean, call it what it is. John may be right on the facts, the legal facts, but this is really just about, you know, playing the immigration issue to the base.
So what does this say for sanctuary cities around the country and, you know, these so-called sanctuary cities that have policies like this?
Well, one of the problems, see, the big hammer for federal authority in the modern world is not sending in troops. We don't do that anymore. We cut off federal aid. However, the courts have held that the federal aid has to be tied with whatever the state is doing. So you can cut off discrimination at a university against women and minorities. You can cut off aid to the universities because it has to do with an educational decision being made by the university. It's not clear what kinds of funding they would cut off to California. I suppose there might be some people in the country who would like to see California secede from the Union.
Now there's some liberals who want Texas to go, too.
Let's bring in Nate in Milwaukee on this. Good morning, Nate.
Hi. An odd historical connection I thought of was actually the Fugitive Slave Act, which during the slavery times in the South was the most popular federal law they could have. And a number of free states actually put in place laws fining people for cooperating with slave catchers, because even though they couldn't, as their own state, make the fugitive slave law illegal, they could make it harder for people to actually enact it. So that's an interesting comparison on federalism grounds.
Nate, thanks for the call. Thanks for showing us the parallel. What do you make of that, John?
Nate's absolutely right. One of the very first and early decisions of the Wisconsin State Supreme Court was to nullify the Federal Fugitive Slave Act. What's interesting about it is that the feds appealed it to the Supreme Court, and Wisconsin didn't even send a lawyer down to Washington to argue a case.
It wouldn't have mattered with Roger Taney on the court anyway.
But what is fascinating, I come back to the broader issue here. The broader issue is the degree to which Americans use federalism to advance their particular causes. We would not have the situation we have with gay and lesbian marriage being legal if it hadn't been fought at the state level, state by state, until it finally ended up in front of the Supreme Court. The movement for legalizing marijuana, state by state, until it rises up to a national movement. So federalism can serve for reform groups to change America that can also serve as a way to resist federal authority. The latter turns out to be a difficult task as far as the courts are concerned.
And that percolation is a good thing when it percolates up from the state when ideas change.
Absolutely. We would not have the great reformation in the laws governing gays and lesbians without that, all those states fighting that battle one state at a time.
Will California be able to change America on the issue of immigration by what it's doing? Or will it be tamped down?
I don't think they can do it. On this issue, they can't. The federal authority, when it comes to immigration, is absolute. It's paramount. The legislation supports it. They will lose this case.
Well, meanwhile, there's a Russia probe, and the Russia investigation is continuing. Paul Manafort, President Trump's former campaign chairman, entered a plea of not guilty to charges that stem from special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into possible collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign. His trial, according to The Hill, will begin in July. So, Joe Winicky, you first. What are you watching here as this Russia probe goes forward?
Drip, 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 and drip. Every day it's something new and something more. And it's clear that it's the circle around Trump and family and the inner circle is getting tighter and tighter and tighter. I expect big and very provocative things happening in coming weeks.
What about you, John?
I don't think there's anything there. I know that's a radical thing to say. Mm-hmm. I think that the cases that are coming forward now are about criminal behavior well before the election that had to do with a lot of seedy dealings in terms of international finance and international deal-making. We have yet to see what's hoped here is that one of these people indicted for earlier misdeeds will break and begin to cooperate with something that has to do with Trump. One of the things that's important for Americans to keep in mind, it is not against the law, even if Trump met with, and I don't think he did, I don't think you're going to find that, but even if he organized meetings before the election or right after the election, none of that is impeachable. Is it seedy? Is it inappropriate? Is it something that we don't want a president to do? Absolutely. But it's not grounds for impeachment.
High crimes and misdemeanors in the eye of the beholder, John.
It's not a criminal act.
I disagree.
All right. Well, we will be leaving it there on this edition of Week in Review. John Sharpless, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation. It's been a while.
Joe Winicky, thank you so much for
being here. As well.
John Sharpless is a professor of history at the UW-Madison. Joe Winicky is a former state senator, and he is a former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. This Week in Review was produced by Breanne Shasso and Bill Martins. Michael Deringer provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Have a great weekend. We'll meet you back here Monday on the Ideas Network for more great conversation. On Point is coming up next.